Rivals is a production of iHeartRadio. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Rivals, the show about musical beefs and feuds and long-simmering resentments between musicians. I'm Steve.
And I'm Jordan, and welcome to the jungle, baby. It's the only way to open this episode.
And you're not going to die, right? We can assure our listeners that they will survive this episode.
But we don't have fun in games.
Even if they're going into the jungle.
We have spite and bile.
Yeah, you know, on our show, usually, you know, we talk about rivalries between, you know, one person and another person. But in this episode, it's basically like one guy versus the entire world.
Man, I mean, you gotta love Axl Rose and just all of Guns N' Roses. They're just always starting shit. They're writing songs that piss people off, dropping F-bombs on TV, peeing in places where they're not supposed to be peeing. I mean, it's just, you gotta love them.
You do have to love them. They were one of the biggest bands of my youth, one of the first badass rock bands that I ever loved. And, of course, their big album came out in 1987, Appetite for Destruction. And then they put out two enormous albums, Use Your Illusion 1 and Use Your Illusion 2 in 1991. And many great songs came from those records, November Rain, Don't Cry, You Could Be Mine. But the song we're going to be talking about today, not one of the best songs from those records, but very memorable, especially in terms of
rivalries. The most infamous.
Yes. Of course, we're talking about the song Get in the Ring. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about Axl Rose versus everybody that he name checks in Get in the Ring.
Axl versus all.
Axl versus all. And, you know, we're going to get into this in the episode, but like one of the big things that fascinates me about this song is that I feel like it wouldn't exist now. Like if Axl could have gone on Twitter or Instagram in 1991 and just vented a little bit, he probably wouldn't have had to spend millions of dollars in recording studios to record this song and then put it on an album that went on to sell like a gazillion copies.
I mean, that's a comforting thought. I feel like that might be giving him more credit in the sanity department than he might actually have. Like, he might have actually really appreciated the fact that this angry letter took millions of dollars and hours of studio time. Like, that might have been part of the appeal.
Well, I think we can both agree that we're glad that he didn't just tweet about this, that he put it on a record, because here we are almost 30 years later, and we can still dive into the minutia of Axl Rose's beefs with the rock press in the early 90s. So without further ado, let's get into this mess.
So we take it back to the release of Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 in September 1991. And I always thought this was kind of the rightful successor to the Appetite for Destruction, right? Like Lies for me just didn't cut it.
Yeah, I mean, Lies does have Patience on it, one of the great Guns N' Roses ballads. But you're right. It was basically like a stopgap release while the world waited for Axl to make these two huge, just massive albums.
And I always thought Use Your Illusion were kind of like Axl's Plastic Ono Band record in a way, because it came out around the same time that he got really into regressive therapy, and which dredged up all sorts of childhood traumas with his dad and stepdad and his mom and, you know, all these horrible things, which, I mean, he always had a temper, but this shortened his temper into like microscopic territory here. And I feel like these discs are just the result of that. They're just panoramas of bile and score settling.
Yeah, you know, I love that comparison. I don't think I've ever heard that before, but it just makes me think of like if Axl would have said, "I don't believe in Guns N' Roses, I just believe in me." That would have been beautiful if that could have been a lyric on this record. But I think you're right. I mean, the influence of Axl going into therapy was undoubtedly an influence, not just on these albums, which, as you say, are just full of bile and confessional songs about Axl's youth and everything that he's gone through in his life. It also translates to the music videos that they put out at this time. Are you familiar with the trilogy of great over-the-top music videos that they put out for the Use Your Illusion albums?
Yeah, there's some mysterious appearances of sea creatures in there that I never really understood.
Yes, Axl does swim with the dolphins in the video for Estranged. That is the final video of the trilogy, the Return of the Jedi, if you will, of the Use Your Illusion era music videos. You've got Don't Cry. That's the video like where Axl literally walks through a mirror at one point while conversing with two other versions of himself, which is incredible. Then you have the November Rain video, which is, I think, the most iconic of the three. You know, to carry over the Star Wars analogy, this is the Empire Strikes Back of the Guns N' Roses trilogy. And we can agree Empire is the best Star Wars movie, probably, right, of the original three?
Oh, yeah. Oh, easily.
And I think we can agree that November Rain is the critical nexus point of the Guns N' Roses trilogy. You have Axl, you know, having a wedding with Stephanie Seymour. You have Slash throwing his guitar into the canyon. All sorts of great stuff. But yeah, the dolphins really jump out at me from a strange...
Yeah, does anyone with a Freudian background know what dolphins mean? Please tweet at us, because I really do want to know like what that represents in like his dream psyche.
I just know it has something to do with use your illusions, like using your illusions and dolphins. There must be some kind of connection to be made there. But yeah, you know, I think the power of those records, and you know, we're poking fun at them because obviously they're, you know, very over the top and bloated in their own way. But I know for me as a kid, like those albums meant the world to me, and when I listened to them, I heard songs about teenage alienation. Like I could really connect with them on a universal level. But when you dig into the lyrics, I mean, they're incredibly specific in terms of Axl's inspirations. And it's usually just him ranting at somebody for some wrong that's been done to him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's a shame because I was born in December 1987, and I wish that I could have gotten to experience GNR in real time, because sort of experiencing it in the early aughts when Buckethead was there and Axl was like knee deep in Chinese Democracy tapes, like it kind of colors your view of, you know, their back catalog. And this is a great example. I mean, there's so many pissed off songs where just the message is Axl just kind of writing an angry letter. You've got Right Next Door to Hell, which is about his beef with his neighbor who accused him of hitting her with a wine bottle, which, you know, I mean, writing a song about hitting your neighbor with a wine bottle is a totally normal thing to write a song about. Right, Steve?
Well, and I was going to say, like, isn't she the one right next door to hell? Like, if he's hitting her with a wine bottle, like, I feel like she should be singing that song, not him. I mean, unless he's saying that it's hell to be accused of hitting someone with a wine bottle. You know, I just feel like...
Oh, yeah, he said he was the victim. He is the victim in the case of hitting somebody with a wine bottle. That's a very Axl Rose point of view. But
I'm with the neighbor on this one. I feel like if Axl was your neighbor in the early 90s, you're the one living next door to hell. Whereas Axl should have written a song called Right Next Door to an Innocent Person Who's Just Trying to Live Their Life. You know, that should have been the title of his song.
The worst part is that was apparently was her bottle of wine, and it was supposed to be like a very nice bottle of wine too. She's also out a bottle of wine.
Yeah, I mean, at least hit her with two buck chuck, you know, like not the good stuff. But at any rate, not that you should hit anyone with a wine bottle. I'm just saying
that's our PSA. Don't, please, if you're listening, don't hit your neighbor with a wine bottle,
especially expensive stuff,
right? So you've got that. You've got Back Off Bitch, which is about Axl's girlfriend, old girlfriend from when he moved to L.A. in the early 80s. But I guess she kicked him out over his surprise, his anger issues. So Back Off Bitch, that's another one.
Yeah.
You have Estranged, which you mentioned.
Yes.
Sort of about from a bummed out period from his life after his marriage to Erin Everly was annulled.
Yes.
What else we got? We got You Could Be Mine, which is about Izzy's failed relationship with his ex-girlfriend. And then, of course, you have in the liner notes, I forget if it's one or two or both, you have you have Fuck You, St. Louis.
Yes.
Which is a, you know, it's rare. I'm not familiar with too many bands calling out an entire city in their liner notes. Is that, this is unique, is that not?
That's a unique thing, especially when it's over an incident that was entirely your own fault. You know, like I think we can see a pattern here, like where, you know, Axl's writing a lot of songs about girlfriends who he feels did him wrong, but it's clear that he was just like a really angry, belligerent person and brought all these things onto himself. And in the case of the St. Louis incident, you know, I feel like it's the ultimate example of that because, of course, GNR, they played a show in St. Louis in 1991 and a riot ensued. Because Axl refused to finish the show. He blamed the security. What was the, can you do an Axl impression here? Like what was the exact quote that he said before he stormed off?
Well, he saw somebody in the audience with an unauthorized camera and he just kind of like looks to the side of security. Security, get that guy. And then he's dressed like, in my memory, he's dressed like every one of the village people all in one person.
Oh, yeah.
He's got like a leather police hat and like a feather boa and a huge crucifix. I don't know if anyone in the village people had a crucifix, but in my mind they did. And he tosses off his hat and he dives into the audience. Duff and Izzy, I think, are the only ones just kind of like playing these like low, almost like the Jaws theme. And so he's out there wailing on this guy, getting his camera. He comes back on stage and he says, thanks to the lame ass security, I'm going home. And then the best part is he not only does a mic drop, he like spikes the mic as hard as he can on the stage floor and storms off. And the crowd rioted.
And by the way, I just want to say, like, Jordan is like the nicest person I know. So I like hearing you repeat Axl Rose's words because it's a great juxtaposition between your kindness and his petulance.
Would we do like a Rockabye Baby album of like me just reading Axl Rose lyrics to like kids to put them to sleep?
It would. That would be good. I mean, and I think you're going to be trying out this later because, you know, and when we were talking about this episode, I wanted to make sure that Jordan was the one reading the lyrics to Get in the Ring. Just because of his unassuming delivery, I think it just really brings the songs home. We're going to take a quick break to get a word from our sponsor before we get to more Rivals. So, but yeah, speaking of get in the ring, it's another example of Axl essentially using this mammoth canvas that Guns N' Roses has to settle scores with the people that he feels has wronged them. And in this case, of course, it was the rock press. The song originated as a Duff McKagan song called Why Do You Look At Me When You Hate Me? Which...
I love that line.
Great title, by the way.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to know, like, it'd be nice to see like an alternate universe like where that song ended up on the record and not Get in the Ring, because I think that might have been a better song. But at any rate, Axl takes this song and he pretty much chucks everything about it except for the opening line. And he turns it into this screed, essentially. And screed is really the only apt word here. I don't use the word screed lightly, but I think it applies to Get in the Ring. He's taken shots at all of the big hard rock magazines, essentially, of the time. He's talking about Hit Parader. He's talking about Circus. He takes specific shots at two pretty big journalists of the time in the hard rock world. You have Mick Wall, who was a writer for Kerrang, and you have Bob Guccione Jr., the founder of Spin.
And the Gooch.
Look, I remember where I was the first time I heard Get in the Ring. You know, I bought the Use Your Illusion records like the week they came out. This was like a huge deal for me. But I'm curious for you, Jordan, because as you said, like you were born the same year as Appetite for Destruction came out. So you came to these songs a little bit later when they were divorced from their original cultural context. What's your take on the lyrics when you dive into them? And again, like I said, can you please recite them for posterity's sake?
Oh, with pleasure. You know, I mean, on one hand, you feel for Axl. Like, he's an artist, and artists are sensitive folk. He feels persecuted, he feels judged, he feels misunderstood. And, you know, that's not nice. But he didn't say that. You know, and there's a breakdown in the middle of the song, and it came out a little something like this. And that goes for all you punks in the press that want to start shit by printing lies instead of the things we said.
Oh.
That means you, Andy Seisher at Hit Parade, Circus Magazine, Mick Wall at Kerrang, Bob Guccione at Spin. What, you pissed off because your dad gets more pussy than you? Fuck you. Suck my fucking dick. You be ripping off the fucking kids while they be paying their hard-earned money to read about the bands they want to know about. Printing lies, starting controversy. You want to antagonize me? Antagonize me, motherfucker. Get in the ring, motherfucker. I'll kick your bitchy little ass, punk.
Woo! I gotta say that that's...
It's like Opie.
I've never heard someone say, antagonize me, motherfucker, and have me think, oh, what a sweet guy. You just bring the sweetness to that song that doesn't exist otherwise. Yeah, I mean, he obviously just like went off. And again, the idea that he's in the studio recording this song and there's lots of people around him. There's record producers, there's other people in the band, there's people from the record label. I want to read an oral history of all the people that were around Axl when they recorded Get in the Ring. And I want to know, like, did anyone ever try to intervene and say, you know, maybe you know, calling these people.
Oh, it's the opposite. He blames other people. But in later years, I think he was doing an interview on like Eddie Trunk a couple years ago where he was talking, oh yeah, it was Duff's idea to tell me to like really get my feelings out there. And the Geffen A&R head, Tom Zutaut, I think is how you say his name, the guy, Pete Davidson played him in The Dirt. They said, oh yeah, yeah, they were telling me to just speak my mind. It was all their idea, which is, you know, totally bogus.
I mean, we'll get into this in the episode, but I find it hard to believe that there wasn't anyone, any voice of reason who said, Axel, maybe you just want to shout into a pillow for a half hour instead of recording this song. Maybe that would be a better way to get out your aggression than putting this on this enormous record. It's going to be one of the biggest rock records of its time. If that didn't happen, I wonder if people were just intentionally setting him up to humiliate himself, knowing that in 30 years, people would still be talking about it on podcasts and having a laugh over it. You know, it was either they tried to stop him and he wouldn't listen, or there was some sort of sabotage going on in the studio.
Yeah, I mean, just the insulation that must have been around him at that point must have been truly crazy for it to get to the point where this was on the record that sold, what, 7 million? Yeah, it's nuts. But I think to get deeper into Axel's psyche, it's important to know he had sort of like Nixonian levels of paranoia when it came to the press. There was a case in, I think it was just after User Illusion came out in 92, when GNR toured and played a show at Madison Square Garden. And a review in the New York Times described the crowd as oddly restrained, which is, you know, kind of a neutral thing to say. If anything, you could read it as like, wait, why isn't the crowd going more nuts? Great show.
Exactly. And Axel, of course, took it that way, right? Axel wasn't offended when he read that, right?
Not so much. He actually challenged the reviewer to come on stage at the next night show and explain himself. And then when the reviewer declined, I imagine politely declined, Axel went and gave an interview in Rolling Stone and said he didn't have the balls to stand by what he wrote and he got exposed. You know what? I'm not going to make the New York Times any more money. It was an obnoxious piece. It was shit journalism. He's just getting started. He could have written, I didn't like the show personally. I think they suck. But you know what? Okay, fine, cool. You can think we suck and I can think you're an asshole, but don't try to make it look like nobody enjoyed it. And then he went on to call the reviewer a person with some severe fucking personal problems, and he has no business being there or writing about our show. This is from a pretty small comment, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and again, like you said, if you want to read it as an insult, you can, but I think that the more sane way to read it would be to say, hey, this audience is a little dead. You know, this is a great band. Why aren't they being more excited? He's writing about the audience, not so much about the band. So it's like weird for Axel to react this way. It's also, I think another thing that's important to note too, is that like Guns N' Roses, especially for the kind of band that they were, was like pretty critically acclaimed at the time.
Yeah.
Like you know, if you want to talk about other bands from LA, whether it's Poison or Motley Crue or any of those big hair metal era bands, they tended to not get a lot of respect from critics. And yet Guns N' Roses with Appetite for Destruction, people were comparing them to like the Rolling Stones of like the early 70s.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I can't imagine the New York Times like reviewing a Poison show, you know?
Right, exactly.
Like, it's pretty nuts.
Exactly.
Rat.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, like I think Axel was definitely the kind of person who was liable to snatch an insult from the jaws of a compliment. You know, I think that was just his way of looking at it. And it's an interesting segue into talking about one of the big targets of Get in the Ring, which is Mick Wall of Kerrang! Magazine. Because Mick Wall, of course, if you read a lot of hard rock biographies like I do, he's a very famous name. He's written books about Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath. He's written a couple books about Guns N' Roses, including a book called The Most Dangerous Band in the World, which came out in 91, and I remember getting that book. Are you familiar with Mick Wall?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's a legend. He's got another Axl Rose biography, I think. WAR, I think it's called, The Story of Axl Rose from a couple of years ago, and it's another incredible book. He's a legend.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was pretty tight with the band in their early years. He was a champion of them in the late 80s as they started to get really big in the wake of Appetite for Destruction. And he was really one of those guys that like Axl Rose could just pick up a phone and call whenever he wanted to do an interview. If texting existed back then, you would say that he was on you up status with Mick Wall. You know? Like he could text him metaphorically, say you up, and then they would be, you know, having an interview. And it's that very relationship that got Mick Wall in trouble, because in early 1990, Axl Rose calls Mick Wall up. It's like in the middle of the night, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Mick Wall was saying he was like brushing his teeth or something, getting ready for bed. Yeah.
So just.
And he
just,
got you upped.
Just picture, I mean, you and I are journalists. Imagine like you're getting ready, you're in your pajamas, you're getting ready to wind down, brushing your teeth. All of a sudden your phone rings, and who is it? It's 1990 Axl Rose. I mean, pretty incredible thing to have on the other end of the phone. And the reason why Axl called was because he wanted to vent about Vince Neil of Motley Crue. And who doesn't want to vent about Vince Neil? I mean, you've called me in the middle of the night to complain about Vince Neil from time to time.
I mean, if you're going to vent about Vince Neil, you should probably vent about Vince Neil to a journalist. That's probably the best way to do it, I'd say.
And the reason why he was mad was because of this incident that occurred at the 1989 MTV Video Music Awards, where it started with Axl and Izzy Stradlin from GNR performing with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers on the song Free Fallin'. And have you ever seen that performance?
Is that the one with the snake dance? Axl's like,
yeah. It's like prime era Axl. He struts out there like Pepe Le Pew, and he sings the chorus of Free Fallin' with Tom Petty, doing the snake dance, which for my money is the greatest frontman dance of all time, unless you want to give credit to Davy Jones of the Monkees for originating it, because he kind of did the same thing.
Oh my God.
You know, in the video for Daydream Believer?
Yeah. Of course, yeah. I never even made it.
There's always been a theory.
I made that thing piece.
That it's the snake dance, or I've heard, also heard it called the Davy Jones dance that Axl does. But anyway, it's a great performance. But as they're walking off stage, Vince Neil punches Izzy Stradlin, because Izzy supposedly hit on Vince Neil's, was it his wife or his girlfriend?
I think it was his wife. His wife, who was a mud wrestler at the Tropicana, I believe. just a fact.
Exactly. No judgments. I'm just saying, you know, it's perfect that Vince Neil's wife was a mud wrestler at the Tropicana. So Vince punches Izzy Stradlin. And Axl, you know, this is several months later that he calls Mick Wall. He's still angry about this. And he's basically challenging Vince Neil to a fight through an interview with Mick Wall. And it's interesting, you know, when you look back in retrospect, why didn't Axl just punch Vince Neil after he punched Izzy? You know, like if you wanted to fight Vince Neil, you think he would have just done it then.
Seems like the moment was there, yeah.
The moment was there.
And Izzy was like out, right? He was like out cold?
Yeah, apparently he got cold cocked. I mean, I think part of the disagreement here was that I think the idea was that he got sucker punched, that Izzy, you know, had no opportunity to square up and do like a real fair fight, that Vince just decked him backstage. Anyway, Axl was really hot and bothered about this. And he gives this amazing quote. He says, "I tell you, he's going to get a good ass whipping, and I'm the boy to give it to him. It's like, whenever you want to do it, man, let's just do it. I want to see that plastic face of his cave in when I hit him." I feel like I'm doing a slight John Wayne impression here. I'm imagining Axl talking like John Wayne. I don't know.
I wish John Wayne once said, like, ass whooping. I feel like I would like a lost scene from like The Searchers or something.
I'd love to hear John Wayne say Izzy Stradlin. You know, just if someone could do a deep fake of that, that'd be amazing. Personally, I don't think he has the balls, picking up again with Axel's quote here, but that's the gauntlet and I'm throwing it down. Hey, Vince, whichever way you want to go, man, guns, knives, or fists, whatever you want to do, I don't care. Now, I love this story, but like the fallout from it like wasn't very good, and Axl was the one who got mad about it, essentially, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, there's really no ambiguity about these quotes right here. He is challenging Vince Neil to a fight. Like, there's really no, like, metaphor. There's no nuance here. It's very literal. Guns, knives, or fists. So Mick Wall is typing up the interview, and he's reading this all back, and he's thinking, oh, geez, this is pretty tough. And he calls Axl and reads everything back and says, hey, man, like, this is pretty explicit here. You sure you're okay with this? And Axl says, hell yeah, man, I stand by every word. So it gets published in April 1990. It's the cover story for Kerrang. And, you know, as you would expect, it ignited a war between the Motley Crue and GNR camps. And, you know, I mean, they're both from L.A. They run in the same circles. Nikki Sixx and Slash had been friends. This is some, like, Jets versus Sharks shit. It's about to go down.
I remember this playing out on MTV. I didn't see the Mick Wall story, but I remember on MTV News, this was like a big thing. And it's almost seemed like MTV was like trying to perpetuate this, which I loved. I mean, I was eating everything up. Like they did an interview with Vince Neil where Vince Neil is essentially like talking directly to the camera, like Rowdy Roddy Piper, you know, challenging Axel to a fight. And later on in the Motley Crue book, The Dirt, Vince Neil claims that Axel got back to him through an intermediary, and there was this plan that they were going to fight in the parking lot of Tower Records in Los Angeles.
Why you
know,
there?
I don't know. Like by the smoking dumpsters, maybe. I don't know. But apparently, Axel bailed. But even though he bailed behind the scenes, he kept talking in the press that he wanted to fight Vince Neil. Like there was another interview that Axel did with Kurt Loder, where he basically said, hey, man, like, if you want to fight in Atlantic City for a charity thing, like, let's do it. And I think Vince Neil even agreed to that, too. But, like, no matter how often Axel would say publicly that he wanted to fight, it seemed like behind the scenes, he never would commit to it.
Oh, yeah, he blamed the whole thing on Mick Wall. He said that he was, like, a rotten journalist who lied and misrepresented his quotes, which, you know, I mean, you can't misrepresent what's it going to be, guns, knives, or fists. There's not much to misrepresent there. But, you know, how much he actually believed this in his own mind is up for debate. But Mick got blacklisted, and he, I think to this day, has a feud with him. I think in, like, the late 2000s, he, like, still blacklisted him from a Guns N' Roses show in London. So he's still pissed about this.
And, look, Axel, if you want to collapse Vince Neil's plastic face, like, do it, man. Or, you know, don't throw the journalist under the bus. It doesn't seem fair.
But, like, it's the weird thing was, he kind of came out looking pretty good, right, Axel? Like, even though he totally just ran away from multiple attempts from Vince to, like, actually call him on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because this whole thing of, like, Axel getting into fights with people, it coincides with Guns N' Roses shifting in esteem in the public, and it has a lot to do with how the rock scene was changing in the early 90s. Like during that whole Vince Neil Guns N' Roses thing, I think the press looked at Guns N' Roses as a more authentic band, and they were more willing to give Axl the benefit of the doubt in a rivalry with Vince Neil. And you can see in the optics of how that was presented on MTV, like where again Vince Neil was presented basically like a buffoon, you know, like pointing to the camera, wanting to start a fight with Axl Rose. Whereas Axl had an audience with Kurt Loder, like he was the president of rock music at that time. You know, I think they were sitting like in a garden, like maybe behind Axl's house or something. It's just much more dignified, even though Axl is also acting like a buffoon at this time. But that would change, I think, pretty dramatically once we get to the 1992 Video Music Awards. And I don't know if you know this about me, Jordan, but I'm kind of obsessed with the 1992 Video Music Awards.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would love nothing more than to hear you recount this story. This is like a chance to hear Bob Dylan do like a lost verse from, you know, Times They Are Changing or something. I would love nothing more than to hear this from your lips.
Yeah, this is my Freebird guitar solo, I would say, this story. But yeah, it's the story about how Axl and Kurt Cobain almost got into a fight backstage. So the short version is that Axl Rose and Stephanie Seymour, they're walking backstage and they're passing by Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love. And just for some context, like Axl Rose really loved Nirvana. Like he actually wanted to put Nirvana on as an opening act for Guns N' Roses when they did that big Metallica GNR stadium tour. So he was a fan of the band, but like Kurt Cobain looked at Axl Rose as a joke. So
I mean, he viewed him as like everything that was wrong with rock and roll, right? Like it's everything that was like L.A. phony, manufactured, machismo.
Right.
Like, yeah, I mean, like,
yeah,
all
exactly.
The bad
like a macho guy who's dropping racial slurs in songs, you know, disparaging language towards women, all those sorts of things. And Cobain, I think, probably felt that he was the antithesis of that. So Axl and Stephanie Seymour walking by. And Courtney Love shouts at Axl and says, hey, Axel, do you want to be the godfather to our daughter, Frances Bean? Probably not a sincere question. Seems like it was pretty snarky, wouldn't you say?
Some elements of sarcasm could have crept in there, I agree.
And Axel takes it as sarcasm, and he looks at Cobain, and he says, "You shut your bitch up, or I'm taking you down to the pavement." And he's not talking about the band Pavement. This is not like a slanted, enchanted shout out. He's talking about beating up Kurt Cobain. And Cobain turns to Courtney Love, and he says in a deadpan voice, "Okay, bitch, shut up." Which is a great comeback. You know, it's like he's obviously mocking Axel. And then Stephanie Seymour decides to step in to save face for her boyfriend, and she turns to Courtney Love, and she says, "Are you a fashion model?"
This is my favorite part.
Courtney Love says to Stephanie Seymour, "No, are you a brain surgeon?" And that's pretty much, that's brilliant. And that's pretty much the end of it right there. But it's another example of Axel wanting to start a fight and then just totally getting schooled by the end of it.
God, I mean, did John Hughes write that? I mean, the lines in that are incredible, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's something about that incident that the thing I love about it is that it sounds like something a rock critic would have made up as a metaphor for, like, hair metal being replaced by grunge. Like, you would write a scene where Axel and Kurt Cobain have a altercation and Axl Rose is the one who's humiliated, you know? It just feels like a metaphor, but it actually happened, which is beautiful.
That's what I love and miss about the VMAs in the early 90s. It was like the high school lunchroom of the rock scene. Like, you would have all these fights and stuff. Like, oh, it's not the same now.
But, you know, to get back to Get in the Ring, I mean, I feel like the Bob Guccione Jr. part of that song, which to me, like, Guccione Jr. takes it on the chin the most. Like, he seems to, like, Axel's insult of him is very personal and he's really going hard against him. But in a way, that's also the insult that backfired on him the most, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is like the kiss of death in Godfather 2, like when Fredo betrays Michael. It there's so much. He gets it the most because he felt the most betrayed. Because Spin, back in the early days, was a huge champion of Guns N' Roses. I mean, people forget this now, but Appetite for Destruction took something like a year to crack the top 10. And a lot of that was because of Spin calling the album, the future of music, you know. And Spin at that time was sort of the alternative to Rolling Stone. It was new and it was championing all the stuff that Rolling Stone kind of was missing, like hip hop and college indie rock. And so that kind of endorsement from Spin meant a great deal. But Axel's view towards the press, as we touched on earlier, started to get more adversarial. And Guns N' Roses had this contract in the early 90s that they gave to anybody who wanted to interview them. And it was truly an insane contract. It had, what did I have? It basically allowed the band to edit the pieces, allowed them to write the captions, allowed them to maintain copyright ownership of the content. And failure to meet any of those demands would result in a $100,000 payment for breach of contract. I mean, you couldn't, like, as a journalist, you can't sign that. I mean, there's just absolutely no way.
Just to contextualize that for people who, like, aren't in the media, like, there is no pop star alive that would request something like that and get away with it. Like, Beyonce couldn't get away with that. You know, it's insane that even a band as big as Guns N' Roses would have even thought to do something like that.
Well, yeah, at that point, just refuse interviews. Like, don't have it down on paper, these insane requests. I mean, that makes it worse. Because, as you said, it is now on paper. And Bob Guccione basically presented it without commentary. He published the contract just as was in the pages of Spin, basically for mockery, like inviting like fans to just like, oh yeah, you guys want to interview Axl Rose? Well, here's the contract, like sign it and fill it all out and send it off to him. And I guess the Guns N' Roses offices were just inundated with tens of thousands of copies of this bogus contract just because Bob encouraged them. So he humiliated the group. And it gets worse. Spin, you know, at this point, obviously, Axel has some, you know, he's very controlling of his image, shall we say. There's a man named Danny Sugarman. He was a music industry figure. He started off when he was younger managing The Doors right after Jim Morrison died. And I think he managed Iggy Pop, too. He wanted to write a book about Guns N' Roses, and the band wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. So I guess Danny Sugarman spoke briefly to Axel at, like, a bar for sounds like it was like a 15-minute conversation. It wasn't anything big. But he took this short conversation and spun a whole spin cover story out of it, which Bob published. And the Guns N' Roses team were not happy. They were basically like, we didn't agree to this. We didn't realize this was on the record. This was not what we, you know, what we said could happen. And instead of blaming Danny Sugarman, he blamed the Gooch, Bob Giacconi. And that really sets the stage for his verse in Get in the Ring, which would you like to take this again? I know it's my favorite part of Get in the Ring.
Yeah, it's, again, you know, the line directed at Gooch. I like that you called him Gooch, by the way. We'll just call him Gooch for the rest of this episode. What, you pissed off because your dad gets more pussy than you? Fuck you. Suck my fucking dick. Now, let's step back for a minute. The context for that line is that Bob Guccione's dad, the senior, of course, is the founder of Penthouse Magazine. And I guess the implication here is that as the founder of Penthouse Magazine, senior has a way with the ladies that perhaps his son does not. So very personal there, going after him. Now, there's this next verse in the song where he says, you be ripping off the kids while they be paying their hard-earned money to read about the fans that they want to know about, printing lies, starting controversy. You want to antagonize me? Antagonize me, motherfucker. Now, do you think that's directed at everyone or just Guccione Jr.? Because it does seem like Guccione, more than anyone else, was antagonizing Axl. Like, he was a champion early on, but he was really poking the bear that contract thing.
Putting on my sort of reading comprehension hat for a moment, it could apply to Mick Wall, too, because he did say that the whole Vince Neil thing was completely made up. But I don't know. I prefer to think that it's just at Gooch. Just like the whole rest of the verse is all at him.
Now, Axl, you know, of course, after the antagonize me, motherfucker part, he says, get in the ring, motherfucker, and I'll kick your bitchy little ass, punk. A clear challenge, a callback to the, what was that, the knives, fists, or guns thing from the Mick Wall interview. I mean, he's...
Exactly, no ambiguity.
Unequivocally, you know, shouting this guy out, asking for a fight. But it's fair to say it didn't turn out the way Axl thought it would, right?
I mean, the problem was Bob was more than happy to get in the ring. Like, Axl probably didn't know that the Gooch had something like 10 years of full contact karate experience. So he was down to go.
Yeah, and he was also like a total sleazebag. Yeah. I mean, that's the other element. And I think he liked the publicity that he was going to get from this.
Oh, yeah. No, he wanted to turn in this big stunt for Spin. And I guess he sent Geffen a letter after trying to get in touch with Axl a bunch of times. And the letter was published, I think, in a bunch of different newspapers. I like to read a part of it now. I enjoy how cordial yet ass-whooping it is at the same time. I think I have a special talent for reading these kind of things. I have just heard your song Get in the Ring, and I want you to know I hardly accept the challenge and thank you for the invitation. Seemed very cordial.
Let's do it,
I say, at your earliest convenience. By the way, I mentioned in the press that I'd be only too happy to oblige you. I take the fact that there's been absolutely no response from you to indicate how busy you must be. I mean, what with canceling concerts, starting riots, and beating up paying fans trying to take pictures of you, what a schedule you've had. Incredible. I sympathize. So I just wanted to let you know directly that as soon as you're ready, I am too. Perhaps until then, you shouldn't sing that song. At least not too loudly, huh? What a great letter.
I'm just picturing him with like white gloves and, you know, slapping Axl in the face, you know, like I accept your challenge of a duel, you know, let's meet guns at dawn. You know, that's very much the tone of that letter.
Oh, it's so good. And then he was on A Current Affair like a short time later, and he had another great quote about Axl. I don't think Axl Rose sits at home and wonders how he can make himself look like more of a bad boy. I just think he's a bad person.
Which, touche. I think that was probably a pretty fair assessment of Axl at that time. So, like, did Axl just take that lying down? I mean, was that the end of it?
He kind of doubled down. He was given a concert in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is actually my hometown, in December of 91. And he claimed that he was not only going to sue magazines, like all the magazines he mentioned, presumably, but also that the people that he mentioned in the song put a hit out on him, which he called, I think he called it a real pussy approach, putting a hit out on him.
Well, you know, I guess, yeah, if that had any connection to reality, I suppose hiring a hitman to murder Axl Rose over Get in the Ring would be, you know, not the best move. Although, no. Again, I feel like that probably was not grounded in anything that actually was in the real world at that point.
No, absolutely not. I mean, so when push comes to shove, Axl backs down. He tries to justify it in an interview. He basically says that, yeah, getting the ring isn't necessarily literally about getting in the ring with boxing gloves, you know? Otherwise, I'd be a boxer. But, you know, to get in the ring, you need integrity. And that disqualifies Bob right off the bat. So that song about getting in the ring wasn't actually about getting in the ring. And even if it was, I wouldn't fight Bob because he doesn't have integrity. So there's some fun logic there.
Yeah, I like the idea that I can't kick your ass if I respect you. I only beat up people that I respect and that have integrity. You wrote a song about people wanting to fight them because they don't have integrity. And then you had like actual boxing sounds in the song. Like, I think there's like a boxing bell the song, and there's crowd cheering. It seems like a pretty literal representation of boxing in the song. It's a metaphor, sure. We'll let Axl have that one.
All right, hang on. We'll be right back with more Rivals.
I think we need to recap here Axl's non-fighting history, because we've talked about the Get in the Ring song, of course, and Mick Wall and Bob Guccione Jr., of course, being the two big targets of that song. You have the Vince Neil incident. The knives, guns, or fists. There is no knives, guns, or fists at all in the vicinity of that battle. You have the Nirvana incident backstage, where he's going to take Kurt Cobain to the pavement. Doesn't take him to the pavement. Doesn't even play him Slanted and Enchanted or any of those great albums. Really, the only fight that he gets into that I'm aware of, like as a public figure, involves the fashion designer Tommy Hilfiger. Like, are you familiar with this story?
I love this story so much, because it's kind of like I would say a past his prime Axl too. So it's not even like 90s era. Like, this is like mid-aughts level too, I think. Wasn't like 03 or 06?
Yeah, I think it was 06. Like, they were at some event. Axl was, you know, at a table with Tommy Hilfiger and Tommy Hilfiger's girlfriend. And Axl, from his telling of it, he moved Tommy Hilfiger's girlfriend's drink because there was some calamity that was about to befall her cocktail, supposedly. And then Tommy Hilfiger reacts to that by essentially slapping Axl Rose about the face. And I mean, Tommy Hilfiger says that, like, Axl pushed him first, right? I mean, isn't that his story?
Yeah, I mean, Tommy was acting completely out of fear. Like, I mean, Axl's reputation with all these songs, with getting the ring and everything, it just totally preceded him. And he said, Axl pushed me. And I said, that was rude. And he noticed that Axl had a huge ring on. And so he thought, you know what? If I get hit, it's going to take my eye out. It's going to take my teeth out. This is going to get bad. So it was a preemptive strike.
And I love this quote. Like, Axl was asked about this later. And he said, quote, it was the most surreal thing I think that's ever happened to me in my life. He just kept smacking me, which, you know, I think it would be pretty surreal if Tommy Hilfiger was beating the crap out of you. That does seem like a dream that you would have, you know, on par.
After having too much spicy food, like late at night, and you would have that dream.
Exactly. You know, and maybe that's like some sort of weird anxiety dream about, you know, not feeling good about your wardrobe. So like a fashion designer is beating you up. Yeah, I don't know if that would be the interpretation of that. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I just think it's funny that for Axl, with all the things that have happened to him in his life, even for him, he thought, oh, this is like a cut above the weirdness of my just everyday life. I can't believe that this happened to me.
I think it was a happy ending though, too. Didn't they like patch things up later?
Yeah, I think so. I think they both realized like, wow, this is like such a bizarre thing. Maybe we should just both try to put it behind us and be friends. So anyway, in terms of Axl's fighting history, that is really the only like kind of big fight that he actually got into. Otherwise, it's a lot of talk and virtually no bite coming from Axl.
Right. I mean, you know, it's just funny how this reputation just was really born. Would you say primarily out of getting the ring? Like, I'm trying to figure out at what point that his reputation as this, like, you know, WWF wrestler turned singer began? Like, was it, because looking back on it, I think it's around there, but was it earlier?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was an idea that Axel was a tough guy that predated Get in the Ring. I think Get in the Ring, in a way, was the pinnacle of that and also the beginning of the end. Because the thing about Axel, and again, like, as I said earlier, Guns N' Roses was a big band of my youth. They're still a band that I love. And Axl Rose is like one of my favorite rock stars of all time. And I think the appeal of Axl Rose, in much the same way as it is for someone like Kanye West, who I think, weirdly enough, is like the closest thing that we have to an analog to Axl Rose.
I see that,
Like early 90s Axl Rose that we have now, that he's like 50% cartoon, you know, and 50% like ultra real, keep it real, like human being. You know, like, he's someone that obviously wears all of his emotions on his sleeve and doesn't keep anything back. And, you know, while his prime predated social media, he did have that sort of like oversharing quality that is so common now with pop stars. Like, he had that in the late 80s and early 90s. But then he's also larger than life. And in a song like Get in the Ring, he's basically like a pro wrestler, you know. And it's part of what makes that song, I think, so lovable as a piece of camp. Like, I don't know how you feel about that song generally. I mean, do you appreciate it on that level, or is it just like garbage to you?
I mean, I have a hard time listening to it as like a real song. Like, it's more sort of infamous to me than I have a hard time stripping away the backstory from when I hear it. I don't know. I'd like to read Mick Wall's assessment of the song, which kind of mirrors my own. He calls Get in the Ring a lot of L.A. puff about nothing, a big, Terry hair-pulling tantrum from an overindulged child star shouting and swearing because he can't get his own way. So that kind of goes with how I feel about it. I am curious, though. You mentioned that Guns N' Roses, big band of your youth, somebody you really, I won't say admired, but definitely, you know, have an affection for. As a music journalist now, how do you view that song? Like, do you feel a lot more sympathy and affinity towards Mick Wall and Bob and all the people he called out?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like I put myself in their position, and it just seems unfathomable to me to be in the eye of that kind of storm because, you know, nowadays, I think it's actually pretty common for journalists to end up on the wrong end of a stick with a celebrity. Like, you and I have both had situations like where famous people didn't like something that we wrote, and they called us out on social media, and getting a tweet sent in your, yeah, it's not fun. And having a mean tweet written about you and then having like all of like the minions come out, you know, all the dregs of social media coming out to sort of chime in and take shots at you. That's not fun. And it can be pretty intense for about, you know, 24 to 48 hours, but that's not the same thing as like having a song written about you and having that song on like one of the biggest albums in the world. And you know, just, I mean, like, tweets, they come and go and people tend to move on after not a whole lot of time, but like Get in the Ring is a song that, again, like, here we are, we're like, it's like 30 years later, and we're talking about like how Mick Wall and Axl Rose were feuding in 1990. You know, like, we wouldn't really remember this stuff if it weren't for this song. It just like blows it up to like a whole other like level of like mythical proportions.
It's an immortal feud, like, exactly. It's just it'll never fade. It's so strange.
Yeah, it's crazy. And like, you know, I don't think that this is a great song. Like, I think there are like obviously many other songs from like that era of GNR that way overshadow this song. But in a way, this song is important as far as showing how the perception of Guns N' Roses changed pretty dramatically in the early 90s. Like, the Use Your Illusion albums, they came out the same month as Nevermind, you know, and like Pearl Jam 10 came out, I think, like a month earlier, you know. This was kind of the beginning of the end of like rock stars acting like this and getting away with it. You know, there was like a whole other generation coming in where they wouldn't have acted like this. There was a new kind of sensitivity.
It's like a self-seriousness. You know, like
and like kind of de-emphasizing machismo. I mean, you could say that came back later in the decade, like with all the new metal bands that came back, like the Limp Bizkits and Korns and bands like that. They reiterated that to some degree, but like, you know, I don't think that those bands, as big as they got, were ever on the scale of like Axl Rose in 1991, like right before this band started to go into decline.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, Getting in the Ring is the high watermark right before that sort of wave of ridiculousness just completely crested.
Right. So, I mean, if we look at this song, I mean, normally in this part of the episode, we would like give the pro side for each side of the rivalry. I mean, I think the pro side for the journalists in the song is pretty clear cut, that Axl was insane to write this song and that they didn't deserve to get called out in the way that they did. You know, the pro side for Axl, I guess, would be that 30 years later, when there's no danger of anyone actually getting physically harmed because of this song, to me, again, it just lives on as like lovable camp. And it's something that I enjoy listening to, not necessarily because it's a good song, but just because I think it's really funny. And it usually puts a smile on my face when I hear it.
I think it's like an inkblot test for how you feel about Axl, too. Like, I mean, if you're predisposed like I was, because I got to know him as sort of like the guy who made Guns N' Roses disintegrate because he fired everybody or made it unlivable, and you're predisposed to think that he's kind of ridiculous, you think that this is just the ultimate moment of his ego and just insanity. But if you like and kind of have a soft spot for his brashness, then yeah, I can see this being like a really fun piece of performance art.
What's funny now is that, you know, Axl Rose is now known as the guy who calls out Steve Mnuchin on Twitter.
Yeah,
like he's calling out members of the Trump administration to get in the ring, you know? And like, it's one of those things like where people kind of love him now for that brashness, you know, because he'll do that to politicians. Yeah, I saw someone tweet about this recently where they said, imagine being, it's 1990 and you're thinking about the year 2020 and like what the reputation of Axl Rose is versus Morrissey, you know, things change a lot over the course of decades and how we look at things can shift over time. And even a song like Get in the Ring in its own small way can maybe be redeemed.
Wow, that is a beautiful thought, Stephen. I love that. You've really changed my approach on that.
Well, Jordan, I hope that you and I will never have reason to get in the ring.
Guns, knives, or fists, Stephen. Gun, knives, or Steve. See you in back of the Tower Records parking lot.
All right, man. Well, until then, everyone, we'll be back with more Rivals next week.
Rivals is a production of iHeartRadio.
The executive producers are Sean Titone and Noel Brown.
The supervising producers are Taylor Chacoin and Tristan McNeil. I'm Jordan Runtog.
And I'm Stephen Hayden. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.